This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Members of the Democratic Party, with Reid's leadership, hope to form an alliance against Roberts' confirmation to pressure President Bush to choose a moderate for his next Supreme Court pick. And you're listening to Pacifica Headline News. I'm Leanne Caldwell with Verna Avery Brown and Sid Rackford.
And you are tuned to listener-supported, commercial-free community radio WBAI, WBAI.org, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Stay tuned for Light Show at 2 p.m., but right now at 1 o'clock, stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille.
Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you, with The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Yesterday, we talked about sobering moments in our lives, things that happen that make us realize that we've been living in a kind of dream world. But some incident, some discovery, some realization brings us to a moment of sobriety. Sobering reality is sometimes the result of an undeniable truth. You can hear that program that we did yesterday on the WBAI archives, which you can access through my website, thepositivemind.com, or through the WBAI website. Sobering realities. One of the big questions becomes, why do we need a wake-up call to find reality? Why do we need to be shocked into what's real? What's so hard about reality that's so hard to grasp, to accept? As we watch now in our political environment, in our weather environment, if we see things that we're looking at that are just hard and harder to believe, we look at TV and we see tragedy on television. But by now, we're so immune to seeing tragedy on television because there are so many dramatized tragedies. You know, I mean, there are movies that show tragedies, and there are series that show tragedies, and people shooting each other. That when we watch people drowning in a flood, we're somewhat removed from it. It's not really touching us. So what is it about reality that's so hard to grasp, so hard to accept? There are many different perceptions that many different people believe that reality. Some people believe that reality is just too harsh, that if we all saw what was real, we would get depressed and not even try to live. If we saw reality, we would just quit. There's one theory that says that babies who have sudden infant death syndrome, the crib deaths, there's a higher incidence of those among babies who would be in a foundling hospital, That means they're foundlings. They're babies who are found and they're put in a hospital, and they're brought up, but they don't have parents to pick them up. So what happens is there seems to be a higher incidence of sudden infant death syndrome there. And one theory is that when left on your own, at such an early age, you tend to quit life faster. You touch reality. You see it. You don't get distracted by the touch of someone who picks you up and holds you and fondles you. And you just somehow, an infant realizes, it's rough out there. I think I'll quit. That's one interesting perception. Do you ever feel like quitting? Has reality ever been too hard for you to face? Well, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. I say, if we try to examine it and find out, I say we could dance in reality. I say it's not our enemy. Some other people say that we can't handle all that information. The reason we deny reality is because it's just too much information. too much. I mean, too much. How can I expect that there's going to be an invasion from one part of the world, and then there's going to be a flood, and then a tornado, and then, you know, how do I handle all of that information? I just want to ignore it. I want it to go away. And there's a tendency to try to push things away. So in my exploration of this, I've been in touch with David Weiner. David Weiner, a very interesting man. David Weiner is a science writer, wrote a book called Reality Check. We'll be having him on the air in just a couple of minutes. David's a science writer. He's affiliated with, I think, Minnesota. Well, David, are you with us?
Not yet.
Oh, not with us yet. You're going to get him in a second. David Weiner has a big question. He says your mind knows stuff, but it's just not telling you. He says it sits there somewhere in the back of your brain. And I quote Roger Axtell, who talked about a series called A Series of Nine. He said, is the brain the instrument of the soul, or is it vice versa? And what is conscience, or even consciousness? And what about all those synapses steadily snapping back and forth millions of times in your brain? Why? You'll find answer to those and other mind-boggling questions about the brain inside this book called Reality Check. Let's speak with David Weiner. David, hi. Welcome to WBAI.
Thanks, Armand.
Good. I know you've seen the website at least, so you're familiar with the positive mind and what we're
right, doing
here.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you know our audience is one that is really interested.
Yes.
And not just a passive audience. Yes. What is Reality Check about?
Well, I guess the basic thesis of the book is the fact that science has revealed all these facts that should make us question our core assumptions about ourselves and our world, but nothing really sinks in. We appear to have a virtual reality we all seem to have, and it's very difficult to pierce.
And what is it about ourselves that doesn't seem to sink in?
Well, the one example, I give two or three examples in the book, but the one I like is about the size of the universe. The nearest star, Proxima Centauri, is 4.5 light years away, and the New York Times actually called it our neighbor. And if you were able to travel in a space shuttle at the speed of 400,000 miles an hour, it would take you 7,000 years to get there. In other words, Julius Caesar would be halfway there. And then to get to the end of our Milky Way, and that's going at the speed of light, which is 670 million miles an hour, and which point, you know, time actually stops. I mean, if you can figure that one out. It would take 100,000 years, and to get to the next galaxy, Andromeda, at the speed of light, would take you 2 million years. And beyond that, there are 140 billion additional galaxies, they estimate, each with 200 billion stars. So what does this tell us? I remember sitting on a plane with an astronomer, and I says, is this all true? He says, yeah. I says, in other words, we're sort of lost in the universe. He says, well, I don't know. But I says, it seems to me we are. He says, well, I guess we are. The point is that we hear these numbers, but it doesn't sink in. It doesn't register. We can't. The brain doesn't seem to be able to comprehend that.
I was once looking at a star, and someone said to me, oh, that star's not there anymore. that star burned out.
Yeah.
And we're looking at it because it traveled to us at a certain speed, but, you know, we're looking at something that is no longer there.
Yes.
So what's so important about that? I could look at the moon, but I could get to the moon within, you know, 2 days.
Well,
So why I don't go to a star? How does that affect my reality?
Well, you know, if you take that example and then you go to the other extreme, our genetics, and these are facts that we know, you know, but as I say, they don't sink in. Our genetics and every cell in our body, 60 trillion cells, there's a DNA molecule. And that DNA molecule contains 300,000. This DNA molecule is about 2,000 to 3,000 times smaller than a grain of sand. And yet it contains 300,000 pages of code, four letters, A, G, C, T. The only difference, it appears, between us and a mouse or a potato is how many letters there are on the page or on the pages and how many pages there are. So basically, you know, all human life is the same. But yet when all this came out, and the difference between any ethnic group, between the most extreme ethnic groups, is no more than between a brother and sister. But you know,
it's a tiny, tiny, the difference between us. Let's go back to that DNA realization,
yeah,
because I know that it's so familiar to you. But
yes.
John Stewart said, I like to quote John Stewart. Yeah. John Stewart said, we are one DNA molecule away from a dolphin.
That's right. Well, it's less than that.
It's less than that, right.
A few letters away from a dolphin.
There, but for a few letters go me in the water.
That's right.
Or
a frog or a potato. I mean, it's the life code is all the same, but you never see ministers or government leaders up in front of people with a sheet of paper. And I show one of the actual pages in the book saying, hey, we're all the same. Let's get off this stuff. You know, we're all equal. Let's stop hating each other. You know,
well, so now this gets to what the point of the book is, me and the potato. You know
yeah.
what I mean? I mean, we're a letter or two away. If somebody took the Scrabble board and dropped it on the way to work that day,
That's right,
and knocked out one of the letters, I'd be a potato today.
A potato.
Right?
Any living thing.
Any living thing at all.
Yes.
So the realization, the bottom line of the reality check, is that we are so closely connected to everything around us, including our own breath or the air we breathe, but we deny that. Now, why is it that the human mind does not tend to perceive the reality of this infinite connection?
You know, it's an interesting. I sponsored a conference just last weekend at the University of Wisconsin on prejudice and discrimination. And there was one speaker there who talked about terror management, he called it, which was developed, I guess, or forced or cultivated by an person named Gary Becker. And the terror management theme, which I had never heard of, but I guess is known, is that because we know we're going to die and we know we don't have any answers, that we create all these purposes. We put a purpose on our life to diminish the terror. In other words, we know we came, we were created in 7 days, if that's what our religion says, and we live a life according to what our culture says, and after death, this sort of happens, and this sort of mitigates the terror. That's his contention. And, you know, as I was listening to it, it sort of made sense.
So you think denial of death and the perception of death may be an essential evolutionary development, that the actual denial of it makes us live easier, that if we perceived our mortality and let ourselves perceive our mortality, we may in some way not function as well. Well, this is kind of interesting because when you think about the whole youth market, the whole market of the world that is trying to make you stay away from dying and not accept death, there seems to be a frantic effort to, you know, make you, I mean, there are not many books about, you know, nice ways to die, good places to die,
that's right.
What to do in the last 10 years when you're going to die.
Yeah. Jeez, I think there might be a market for that.
There may be a market.
Pretty narrow.
Sex while dying.
Yeah.
Things that nobody can find a spot for because we're gonna stay away from. We're gonna keep you alive. We're gonna keep you young. We're gonna give you facials. We're gonna give you things that'll make you look younger and stay younger, and you'll never die.
That's great. I think we have a series here.
So reality check is well, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. A couple of series on television have touched it.
Yeah.
Like 6 feet under, they touch that kind of thing. And if anybody's ever seen it, I say if you could ever rent the last episode of 6 Feet Under, you see a relationship to death and the characters that is just spectacular. I was so proud that television could present such a thing because it doesn't deny the existence. Okay, so let's say that the best way. We know about animals, we know about our primitive selves, that if you get wounded, you make believe you're not wounded and you continue on the hunt or you keep running away. If you pay attention to your wound, you're going to likely be attacked and die right there.
Right.
So humans are kind of conditioned to ignore their wounds, ignore that which hurts. Is that part of the denial of reality, ignoring the hurt?
I don't know. All I know is we share a good part of our limbic system with these higher animals. And in other words, the need for survival, That's a core psychological drive, a motivational drive that the psychologists like to call it. Others call it an instinctive drive. And the territorial drive, we all like our territory, and the sexual drive we all know about. And nurturance, attachment to others, as John Bowlby, he developed that body of thought. And then finally survival. And I guess what we have as humans is about 16 ounces of cortex that allows us to think about these things and allow us to be aware of ourselves and be aware of the fact that we're going to die, whereas these higher animals, as far as we know, don't know all that.
But you say that the emotional circuitry in the brain works to sabotage us by creating irrational fears and stresses. I'm jumping ahead in your book.
That's right.
Right? So what is it? Why do we create, or how do we create irrational fears and stresses? And what do we mean by irrational fears and stresses?
Yeah, well...
I mean, we can't be an irrational fear to be afraid that I'm going to be hit by an airplane or right. struck by a flood anymore. What used to be maybe is no longer.
Yeah.
What's an irrational fear and stress?
Yeah, well, as I said, I'm on the external board of advisors of the Health Emotions Research Institute in Wisconsin, and they study this. And it appears that the amygdala, which is an almond-sized organ in our brain, mediates fear. And right next to it is an organ called the stria terminalis, which mediates anxiety. And the neurosciences all point out that we need that. You know, if there's a train coming down the track, we got to know enough to step out of the way. What happens, though, is that these were great organs and components during the time we spent in the caves and on the savannas. It helped us recognize fear right away. But today, it could go over the top. It could go over the top, and so we become irrational. We have irrational fears, a fear of flying when it's perfectly safe, or a fear of going in public if we have a social phobia, or anxiety disorders where we can't be with certain people, or there's even a phobia against. I have the dictionary of anxieties and phobias, and there's about 1,000 of them, including phobias against barber chairs and peanut butter.
Peanut butter getting stuck to the roof of your mouth.
Whatever it
to
is.
To be specific, it's not the peanut butter itself you fear.
Yeah.
It's the stuck on the roof of the mouth.
Yeah, but if people who have that phobia can get a panic attack just
that's
looking
right.
at it.
Just thinking about it.
Yeah.
Fear
so
of
this
the
is what I mean by going over the top.
Well, okay, so let's look at this now. There are irrational fears and irrational thinking because there's a circuitry due to the stria terminalis and the amygdala that was meant there to be part of our survival mechanism, which was going to give us the get up and go should the stuff hit the fan.
Yeah, it was like a burglar alarm.
Right, like a burglar alarm. And that, you're saying, well, that's still there, and it's there and it's ready to get triggered.
Yes.
But now we have things in certain psychological manifestations of this that are, well, what about personality disorders? Wouldn't you imagine all of the personality disorders are based on this archaic survival mechanism?
Theory on personality disorders is that, you know, we may either have a predisposition to them. I think the Minnesota study of identical twins reared apart contends that about 50% of our mental characteristics are inherited. So there may be a biological propensity, whether it comes to being, it depends on the situation. And they also can occur because of certain traumas that we've had in our life. And so there we are. I mean, there's like avoidant personality disorder where we think we're inept, incompetent. It might have been a parent that told us that and harped on us. And so we try to be by ourselves.
So you don't see that as genetic. You see it as a kind of a maturational development of a disorder following a genetic predisposition.
Yes, yes.
Right?
Richie Davidson, who's like the Carl Sagan of psychologists, University of Wisconsin, he talks about resilience and vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
In other words,
mm-hmm.
Some of us might be in a trauma and experience nothing. Somebody else could be in a trauma and develop one of these disorders. It's like having two kids growing up in some poor housing and with abusive parents, and one comes out and is just fine. The other is a mess.
You, I think what I like in your book, and the name of the book, by the way, friends, is Reality Check. The author, David Weiner, W-E-I-N-E-R, David L. Weiner. In part of, he talks about our primitive emotional drives. And he says there are personality disorders which are not formally included under the definition of neurotic disorders, but they should be included at this level of punishment because at their extremes they can cause as much distortion in our outlook as neurosis. Let's get to that word punishment.
Yeah.
Included at what level of punishment?
Well, the brain has a reward and punishment system. Again, this is a throwback to the caveman days, and they're based on our expectations. So, you know, if we're going out on the hunt and we don't get the deer or we don't get the animal, we're automatically made to feel depressed, sad. We didn't succeed. If we catch the deer and so forth, our reward system kicks in, the dopamine reward system, this organ, the nucleus accumbens, and so we feel good. It's sort of automatic. And the punishment could be, you know, not only depression, it could be one of these personality disorders depending on our resilience. In other words, this brain doesn't fool around. I mean, it's, you know.
So, let's get to why is there a punishment again if you...
Well, if you take a look at a chimpanzee, I mean, our system is very similar to a higher animal, the emotional system, or even to a dog where you can actually see the emotions a lot better. Is that we have, there's a whole body of academic study called the pleasure principle. And it's, the pleasure principle talks about the reward system. Again, if we win the game, you know, we're ecstatic, the dopamine's flowing. If we lose the game, we're sad, the serotonin levels actually go down. And this is a way to help primitive man, you know, survive in the wilderness. Hey, you do good, you're going to get rewarded by good feelings, and you don't do good, and you're going to get depressed.
So if you get depressed, and let's say that that's part of the punishment of not surviving well,
right,
then you could develop all of these different, and I'll list them. He said paranoid personality disorder, avoidant
right.
personality disorder,
yeah.
schizoid, antisocial, dependent,
right.
Narcissistic,
yeah.
histrionic.
Yes.
Borderline personality. Nice that you got them all listed with a nice brief
yeah.
definition. What are the different levels of punishment? You talk about a third level of punishment as well.
Well, that would be the psychoses where you know, schizophrenia or clinical depression or a paranoid disorder where you think, you know, you're the king of Egypt.
Do you mean delusional?
Yeah.
Paranoia,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I sort of describe that.
Okay, so what you're saying is that there are different levels of punishment that the brain gives to us in the form of a broken brain. We have
yes.
a broken mind. If we don't make it, if it doesn't work, if we don't get the right nurturing, we don't have the right parents, if we are a little genetically frail,
right.
and then we get broken by what happens around us, we can go to one, two, or three levels of punishment. And what's called punishment is that we get to a point where the brain says, you just can't handle it. We're going to put you in complete denial of reality. And that is going to be the third level, which is going to be psychosis,
right.
which is like schizophrenia, which
right.
is like really gone, or total paranoid delusional systems,
right. Right.
stuff
it's
like that.
It's right out of reality. I guess it thinks it's doing something kind for us.
Yeah.
But yeah, again, there's other people that don't feel anything. You know, I mean, they're not sensitive to any of this.
And there are people who are so attracted to it
yeah.
that they want to lose their mind. There are people who are conscious. I mean, why not take LSD to find out that you can no longer be on the planet? I mean, that's the whole
that's right.
idea.
That's
the
right.
whole idea of drug experimentation was to lose your mind.
Yeah.
Because your mind and reality could be so painful.
And to stimulate the reward system, like cocaine does. But as all these researchers have found out, I mean, the receptors actually get clogged. It takes more and more. And the highs change.
But for a little while there's kind of, you know, in many of the drugs, there's an acceptance of reality. There's a kind of a calm that goes with it. And for that period of time, there is a reward system, which is what kind of hooks people
right.
on it. And then you've got to go further and further to get to that same feeling.
Yeah.
And then, of course, like you said, the receptors get clogged.
Yeah.
And now you're desperate trying to find
yeah.
that sense.
There's a Dr. Norman Deutsch who created a what he calls a pleasure threshold in one of the books on the pleasure system. And he points out, and I've interpolated it, but like a number, a 1 to 5 on the pleasure threshold. A number 1 can feel no pleasure at all, and anhedonia, you know. A number 2 is like a perpetual pessimist, always sees the glass half empty. A number 3 would be like most of us, you know, we have maybe a relative good level of contentment or happiness, and we have our ups and downs, but we revert back to that base level. Number 4 would be somebody who is perpetually optimistic, sees a glass half full all the time, enthusiastic, excited. And the number 5 is manic, you know, over the top again, with excitement and enthusiasm that could border on a disorder. So depending where you are on that threshold, if you're low on that threshold, then you need drugs and alcohol, whatever it takes to get you to feel some joy, I guess some of these people think.
Well, let's go over that again. Anhedonic would be considered low because you feel nothing.
Right.
Right? The anhedonia means, no, you don't feel nothing. You don't feel pleasure.
You don't feel pleasure.
Right. You do feel pain, but you don't feel pleasure. That's right. Anhedonia. Then I would add another one to it, yeah. Alexithymia, which is you feel nothing. You're numb.
Oh.
You know, it's a neurological disorder that I would add and say there's a point at which you feel numb to everything, numb to pain, numb to pleasure. You have no feelings.
Really?
Yeah, I would add that. And I would then, of course, there's the manic reaction, which is over the top. Everything is so good that I'm running as fast as I can.
Right.
Then there's the depressive disorder, which is I'm so closed in, everything is so bad, all I could do is feel myself under the covers hiding out. And then there's the other, which is the kind of the positive normal energy. And you're saying anywhere you are on this thing, whether you're manic or depressed, anhedonic or alexithymic, you got to find some way to get yourself to the point where you feel like living.
Right. Got to take control. You made a point where people sort of cultivate these things. I had a friend of mine who retired. His wife passed away, and he lost the sight of one eye, and he became clinically depressed for 4 years. Nobody heard from him. And finally, one day he called me, he says, I'm back. And I had lunch with the guy. And it turned out his children, you know, took him to psychiatrists and they gave him medication. But as soon as he got home, he threw it in the toilet. He wanted to be depressed.
Right.
He didn't want to lose it because he loved his wife. And then one day he had spontaneous remission. He woke up and it was all over.
Well, what do you think it was about the depression that he didn't want to lose?
Well, he was sad about his wife. He was sad about his job. He was sad. I've known people with cocaine addictions that don't want to get off it because, hey, it's the only thing I've got left, you know.
In a way, his depression was his connection to his wife, that if he lost the depression, he really lost his wife.
Yeah. I mean, every day he got up. He was in his pajamas all day for 4 years. Put on a coat and went over to Wendy's to get a double cheeseburger and French fries. I mean, the guy put on a lot of weight. That was his one meal a day, and his children could get him nowhere. I mean, he was just gone, and we never heard from him. So I thought that was sort of maybe that's typical. I don't know.
And then
I don't think so.
Somewhere in there, something happens. Some piece of life happens that makes you suddenly stop and say, "Okay, I've had enough of that."
Yes.
And as if we had to try to wonder if the universe was interacting with us at any point, which we're going to talk about when we get back.
Yes.
I'd like you to stay with us, if you don't mind, David.
Sure.
Can you?
Yeah.
David Weiner, very generous with his time. The name of the book, Reality Check, and it's very, very interesting stuff. We're going to take a short break, my friend, play a little piece of music I brought for you, and when we be back, David, by the way, your mic is going to be open during this time, so...
Okay.
So even though we are playing music, you might not want to suddenly shout out for the pizza. Okay. All right. We'll be back with you in a couple of minutes, my friends.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Thank you.
Jackie Terrasson, T-E-R-R-A-S-S-O-N, La Javanese. La Javanese.
That's it, man. That's it.
That's it. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM in your dial, bringing you some ideas to think about. And we've been talking about reality for the last couple of days because reality seems to be more and more challenging. Looking at it, accepting it, and trying to keep your head above water, whew, tough thing nowadays. We're speaking with David L. Weiner, W-E-I-N-E-R, who wrote a book called Reality Check, who talks about what your mind knows but doesn't really want to admit, doesn't really want to tell you. And David, you know, I find it fascinating that there is so much of us that finds it so hard. Let's just take a quick look at what is this status imperative? I kind of think that that's such a beautiful concept, and that it helps people understand a great deal about how they might have to deal with difficult people at this time of a harsh reality.
Right, right. Well, I don't know if you remember Robert Ardrey's book in 1967, The Territorial Imperative. And this is sort of based on that. In other words, again, this is something we share with the higher animals, in that there's we share this social dominance hierarchy. And it helped us organize ourselves in tribal groups then. You know, we went from an omega down to the from an alpha down to the omega. And in chickens, it's the pecking order. You know, chicken A pecks chicken B, pecks chicken C. And so we all seem to have our place on this social hierarchy. And the higher we are on this status level, the more pressure there is, the more we're into it, the more we want, the more greed we have. I have a quiz on my website, a power quiz, that's been taken by 700,000 people in the last 6 or 7 years that tells you where you might rank on this status scale. And if you're at the top, it's not pretty. You know, nothing is ever enough.
Right. Up at the top, you got to defend your position. It's like being the alpha male.
Right.
You know, you've got to defend your position because somebody wants to come along and take all your betas.
That's right. I never thought that. Good.
So as the alpha, as being at the top, you got to protect your territory.
Right.
Being near the top, you got to strive to get to the top. Yeah. Being in the middle is kind of okay. Being considered somebody who can't achieve the top becomes a very interesting state of mind.
Right.
What happens to those people? The people who say, "Well, I'm never going to really achieve the top level."
Well, if you're at the bottom of the scale, if you're like a number one or two on the scale, you really aren't concerned about it. You know, we've all known people that don't want responsibility, don't really like to come out of the house, are embarrassed by, having a higher rank and so forth. Like the threes and fours, everything in psychology appears to be on a scale. And I like the scale of 1 to 10 or 1 to 5, mm-hmm. In terms of the intensity of the thing. And, if you're a three or four, you're like the worker bees. You know, you have a relative amount of ambition, but if you don't get there, it doesn't bother you.
So there is an actual part of the brain.
Yeah.
That can relax. Do you know what I mean? When you think about the monkeys, and you think about there's the chief monkey,
right,
and then there's the few that are vying for the top position,
yes.
And then there are some bottom monkeys, and they're just saying to themselves, "Well, all right, I'm not going to get any, I'm not going to get any monkeys, and I'm not going to be having much sex, and I'm not going to be waiting for the top guy to die.
That's right.
But I'll get by. I'll just eat more bananas."
That's right. Charles Snowden, who's the chair of the Wisconsin Department of Psychology, is also a primatologist, and he works with monkeys, and he tells me that the alphas at the top and the omegas don't have status tension. Everybody in between seems to be jiggling around, trying to maneuver up a little bit, you know.
So the very top is no status tension. At the very bottom is no status tension. The difficulty is being caught in the middle of that.
Right.
Now, how does that help you when you've got a difficult boss, or if you're in a workplace? How do you use I almost called it status interruptus, but that sounded like,
I know.
Sounds like a sexual disorder.
Yeah.
but how do they deal with this status thing, the status imperative?
Right.
to...
Well, I actually wrote a book called Power Freaks. I published a couple of years ago, and it gives you ideas for how to deal with this. Because people at the top, and they may be psychopathic, you know, because, you know, 1% of the population is psychopathic. They have no sense of shame or guilt, remorse. I mean, they're totally uninhibited. And most of them are not in prison. You know, they're out around the corner in your office or at the family dinner table. And if they're out of reality, you can't go to them and say, gee, I don't like the way you're doing things. You know, you have to work around it, find ways to deal with them that are not going to have them come back and attack you. So it's a pretty complicated thing.
So what's the lesson we get? What do people do? Do people see they have to perceive that there is a status struggle here, and that a lot of this is about face? I think the best advice I give practically every divorcing couple I see is when the man comes to me and he says, "So I'm in this battle of a divorce. Yes. How do I handle it?" Yes. I say, make sure that you protect the face, the honor, the self-regard of the person you're divorcing. Do not assault it. Don't attack it. Because if you attack it, what you're going to get back is a vicious struggle for survival.
Yes.
That somehow you got to protect the other person's image.
Yes.
And if you're somebody who's in a corporate environment and you see people who are in the struggle, even if you're not in it, you've got to make sure you're always sidestepping that particular power struggle.
Exactly. That is absolutely so true. Because there's no other way to handle it. I mean, if you're aggressive and you don't take the high road. I mean, I had two divorces myself, and, you know, I had good relationships with both wives well after the divorces. Because you got to take that high road unless you're prepared to want to have conflict for however long it takes to get through this thing.
And especially if there are children involved.
Oh, children, yeah. I mean, I always did whatever my ex-wife wanted, you know, just to protect the children. You know, I could afford it, so it was easy. But it's a battle of status, again, you know, who's going to inflate your status and who's going to deflate it. Mm-hmm. You know, they say something to you about your family or something else, and it's a status deflator, and so we're punished. We feel bad about it. And so we talk to people about, you know, what school you're going to, or somebody asks your children, what school you're going to? And you say, well, I'm going to Harvard or something. And that's a status inflator. But if you're just going to, you know, some small school, they'll say, oh, isn't that wonderful? In other words, they're very happy to hear that because it makes them feel better.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this lurking in our mind all the time. It's it was interesting. I met this fellow last weekend, Jim Sedanius, who wrote a number of books and is considered one of the world's authorities on what he calls SDO, social dominance orientation. And he contends that the neurotransmitters that mediate this are serotonin, again. In other words, the alphas at the top have high levels of rich concentrations of serotonin, and the omegas at the bottom have low levels of serotonin,
mm-hmm.
and also testosterone, he says.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it makes sense, and I report on that in the book.
Interesting. You know, let's move a moment to another concept. Since you believe in such an organic, fundamental evolutionary development of mankind and his reaction, both from the nurturing point of view and the genetic point of view, let's talk about evil in the world.
Right.
Do you believe there is an evil personality, David?
Well, the fellow that wrote the foreword to my book, Robert Hare, is like the world's leading authority on psychopathy, psychopaths. And so I've gotten very close to him because when I wrote Power Freaks, it dawned on me that being a psychopath in the corporate world, and I'm in the corporate world, is prevalent. And he wrote a book, Without Conscience, which was based on a book by a man named Harvey Kleckley, who in the 1942...
Yes, I've reported on that, and I have that book here, right here in my studio.
Yeah, The Mask of Sanity.
Right.
And a psychopath... So I asked Bob Hare one night at dinner. I said, well, why is, Bush and all these high-level government people talking about the concept of evil, when really we're talking about psychopathy? And he said, well, in his opinion, the way he's determined, a person who is evil is a person who is psychopathic, sadistic. In other words, when they hurt people, they get a high from it. And they're sane. They don't think they're the king of Egypt. And, you know, I sort of agree with that. Because
so
if you look at
all... that again. Psychopathic.
Psychopathic
means without conscience.
Without conscience, no feelings of guilt, remorse, shame. They're aggressive. They have a grandiose sense of self-worth. They're uninhibited. And sadistic, which means they get a high out of hurting other people. They probably hurt animals when they were young. I mean, it used to be sadistic personality disorder in DSM-3.
Took that out, didn't they?
They took it out because of the lawyers. They thought, well, gee, they didn't want anybody to get off, you know, because they're sadistic as a disorder. So in
I thought because the lawyers fell under the category.
Yeah. That's right. So to me, that's a personification of evil. It's not some religious spirit, I don't think. It's something. It's the function of the brain. The pathology is bad. And you know, we had a conference on psychopathy, and now they've just formed a society because only 6 million a year has been spent doing research on it. I mean, here's one of the worst maladies of all, and the pathology is missing in these people. They just don't feel anything, and they can diagnose it in some cases as young as the age of 4. They can make a definite diagnosis at the age of 7, and that's all she wrote. I mean, there's nothing you could do. There's no treatment. So the thing you have is the threat of prison and punishment and so forth.
So evil is not just the psychopath who may become who may get by in life through, you know, joining some profession where they get off on not feeling any consciousness or guilt, and they could be, you know, salesmen, attorneys, they could be vice presidents, they could be any number of things.
Anything.
And that's one group, but now the evil person is that very same person with a true evil sadistic intent.
Yes.
Right? It's not just, I don't have a conscience. I don't have a conscience, but I want to hurt you.
That's right.
And I want to hurt you, and hurting you makes me feel...
real good.
Real
stimulates
good.
The reward system. You know, the nucleus accumbens, probably. You know, makes them smile. And so it's in the brain. And they just formed for the first time, and I was out there in Vancouver about 2 months ago, a society for the scientific study of psychopathy. They hope to get federal. Believe it or not, I was sitting next to this woman who's with the National Institute of Mental Health. This was when I was doing Power Freaks, and I said to her, geez, I can't find much research on this. You know, I thought this would be an easy book to write. I said, why isn't there much research on this, on psychopathy and power? She says, well, say we did the research and we developed the pill. She said, who would take it?
Right. Nobody.
In other words, Adolf Hitler wouldn't take the pill.
Right.
But he thought he was perfectly normal.
Yeah. You'd have to force it on somebody. It would have to be required. Because the prisons are filled with people with that disorder. And it would be, you know, it might be some way to introduce it at that point if there were a way, you know. But
But they're out there. They're out there. Bob Hare is writing a book called Snakes in Suits about the white-collar psychopath who's not dumb. I mean, you know, he'll use the psychopathy to help them rise in the corporate world.
For sure. For sure. You know, I'd like you to send me a copy of your book on power. I would like to do that, and I would like we'll make sure we get that, because I'd like to do a different show on that.
Okay.
Now, what is consciousness? What is it to you? What is the concept of consciousness? What does that mean?
Well, you know, it's in one of the chapters of my book, and I must have spent a month on it. Trying to figure out where it is, and it turns out nobody knows. You know, Descartes thought it was some kind of theater of the mind, and that's basically what it is. But you know, nobody knows where it is. Nobody knows what it consists of. Daniel Dennett, I think, wrote a book, Consciousness Explained. It's about 430 pages, and it's all theory. You know, where it might be. So here we are, and not only do we not know where our consciousness is, we don't know how we think. We don't know how we add five and five, what the cognitive process is. You know, so I saw one academic make the point, well, if we don't know how we think, then what do we know? In other words, this could all be some kind of illusion. I mean, if you want to get to the somebody's far out views.
Well, no, it's almost like Descartes, you know?
Yes.
Because I think, therefore I am.
Yeah.
But is it, so what is thinking? And what is consciousness? So what do you come up with, David? What do you think it is? Do you think it's God? Do you think there's a universe? Do you think there's, what do you think? You must sound to me like somebody who's who's been really working very hard on the fundamental realities as very hard as he can. But I hear this very high consciousness in you, and I hear this connection you have
yes.
to the universe through your learnings, through your
yes.
awareness. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the spiritual you.
Well, actually, in my book, I talked about how Descartes and these philosophers in the 1600s came up with all kinds of theories on the soul and the spirit world and how this all connected at the pineal gland in the brain. In other words, their contention was that while the brain might hold our intellectual capabilities, our creative capabilities, the emotions and the feelings came through these outside forces. And I was writing this one day when the person who cares for the plants in my home came in, and I said, "Boy, would you believe this? These guys think the emotions are in the bottom part of the heart or something." And she says, "Well, no, that's not right at all. They're in the upper part of the heart." So I actually commissioned a survey. I had Cinevate, which is a public company, do an email panel of 1,000 people, and it turns out that less than 20% think the emotions are in the brain. Less than 20% think the emotions are in the brain. Everybody else thinks it's in the heart or in the gut and so forth and so on. But it turns out they are in the brain, and the brain is all physical. And
okay, yet, now take that
yeah.
to David Weiner, this guy who's been through life, who's written a number of books, who's yeah. examined, who does tremendous work on understanding emotions. Yeah. And now take that, and let's take that and shape that. And we'll say, you, David, the person,
yes.
somewhere along the line, you say, you know, there's a bigger deal here.
Yes.
Your experience.
Yes.
What is your experience of God? I don't mean what you wrote in a book. What
yeah.
is your experience? Because I hear it. My audience hears it.
Yes.
You're a man who's big.
Yes. Well, I was raised in a Jewish household. I was religious. I was bar mitzvahed. I did all that. I went to temple with my first ex-wife, and then about the age of 42, I'm 72 now. At the age of 42, something happened, and maybe it was whatever I was studying. And as I've gone into this all this work and try to figure it out, and I could tell you that the neuroscientists don't really have it figured out. They know the physical things, and like you can make diagnosis of mental disorders. So I became an agnostic. They have this whole big argument on intelligent design versus evolution, and I'm saying that the three biggest answers that we need to have, and nobody seems to be looking at, is number one, what happened before the Big Bang? What was going on? We should know that. What was the idea of the Big Bang, the universe, and whose idea was it? I mean, we have absolutely no idea. And yet we've placed all these belief concepts to try to come up with reasons, and that's all they are. We seem to be impelled to place a purpose on our lives. And people think that, well, gee, if you're not religious and so forth, you haven't got great beliefs, you're going to be depressed. But I'm not depressed. Maybe I am, but I don't think I am. And I'm just curious. And I think we should all be curious about what it is that's driving us. And it appears to be all in the brain, and we're not even past home plate in terms of what neuroscientists know about the brain.
So what happened to you at age 42 that brought you to the kind of wake-up call about yourself? Did you say, phew, there's more to this than I thought?
Yeah.
Was it something that happened? Was it a white light? Was it a religious experience? Did you get a divorce? Did you?
It was a divorce.
Yeah,
a divorce.
So.
A divorce usually changes somewhere. And I went through one of these. I was going through everything. I went through this movement called EST. Remember that?
Yes, Werner Erhard. Remember EST. Sure, Werner Erhard.
Yeah, Werner Erhard. So I went through that. That it says if you get it, whatever that was, it changes your perspective a little bit. And it happened to me. And then I was reading a book by Carl Sagan where he's talking about genetics and all these elaborate numbers and the universe and the brain, and that got me going. So at that point, I began writing a book called Brain Tricks. It took about 10 years and didn't do very well, but it's still in print. And after that, I realized I really liked that psychology was part of this, and so I began to learn that, and then began developing these books.
And you developed at some point a sense of yourself that's part of a greater universe
yes, yes.
that makes reality a very acceptable, and from what I hear from you, a well-spirited reality. You know what I mean?
The idea is to try to accept yourself. It's very hard. And today, when people have all kinds of expectations about you, to accept where you are, to lower your expectancies in life so that if you're disappointed, it's not going to destroy you. So I accept who I am right now, you know. And that was very hard to do, you know, to be happy with myself.
Yeah, I hear. Hey, listen, David, it's been a lot of fun being with you. I do want to get you back here.
Okay.
So we could do that other program. And we'll do the one on power, which I'm interested in. This is Armand DeMille, our guest, David Weiner. David, lots of fun. Thanks for having you with us. And
thanks, Armand. That was great.
Yes, yeah, talk again. What's your email address?
It's dave@msinet.com.
msinet.com?
Yeah.
And does the book have a website? Is there a
website? Yeah, it's a reality check book. .com. You can take that quiz on there. It's a lot of fun.
Okay, thanks for being with us.
Okay, thanks.
This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. David Weiner, author of Reality Check. Be back with you, my friends, tomorrow at 1 p.m. Hopefully, there is one little exception that might happen. But I'm going to try to get here, and I'll certainly be with you. If you want a copy of today's program, you would call 212-757-4488. Send me an email, Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, @brainlink.com. Nice to be with you, friends.
I have decided to read another book.
Good.
But I don't have another book.
You should get another book.
But I don't know where to get another book.
Where'd you get the first one?
I got it at the WBAI Book Fair.
Well, WBAI is having another book fair.
Then that's where I'll get another book. When is it?
The WBAI Book Fair takes place Monday, September 26th through Friday, September 30th, 3 to 9 p.m.
At the usual place?
Yes, WBAI at 120 Wall Street, 10th floor. Bring photo ID.
Books I like at bargain prices.
Picture books, novels, medical and countercultural books, political diatribes, and self-improvement books.
Will they have CDs, DVDs, and videos too?
Yes, and this book fair will feature noted authors who will sign their books.
Wow. Will there be new authors every day?
Yes.
Like who?
Like Doug Henwood.
Wood, ooh, Esther Kaplan, wow, Colin Channer, wow, Elizabeth Nunes, yes, Michio Kaku, ooh, Clayton Patterson, mm, Janet Coleman.
Wow. What should I wear to meet a noted author?
How about glasses?
Glasses?
Reading glasses.
Oh, okay. I'll get a pair.
Cool.
Yo, this is Michael Franti from Spearhead, and you're listening to non-commercial radio in New York. WBAI is the place to turn to. Peace.
Oh my God. And my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God. And my mother got a sleeping genocide singing. Oh my God. And my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my. Oh my God, oh my God.
Prior to the September 24th anti-war march in Washington, D.C., a coalition of activists is sponsoring the International Tribunal on Haiti with an open session on Friday, September 23rd from 7 to 10 p.m. at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs, 1957 East Street. Testimonies and evidence of human rights violations, massacres, and murders of Haitians opposed to the U.S.-supported government will be presented. The tribunal will prepare a case to be submitted to the International Criminal Court. Buses will depart on Friday morning from Brooklyn, Queens, and New Jersey. For information and tickets, call Haiti Progress at 718-434-8100, The Answer Coalition at 212-533-0417, or Mashe Lakai at 973-374-9697.
As most of us know, the multi-award-winning program Like It Is, hosted by Gil Noble, is the nation's longest-running African-centered public affairs program aired on commercial television. This Saturday at 2:30 p.m., CIMOTAP, the Committee to Eliminate Media Offensive to African People, is hosting a conversation with Gil Noble. Come out and get the latest information on the future of Like It Is and participate in a discussion on current media issues. That's this Saturday at CIMOTAP. CIMOTAP is located at 135-05 Rockaway Boulevard in South Ozone Park, Queens. For information, call area code 718-32.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.